Hi, my name is Mandy and my pronouns are she and her. I'm the Director of Religious Education at James Reed. Today, I'm going to show you a video about a Westboro Baptist member that left the church and faced what she did as a child. However, first, I wanted to share a personal story. For this, you need some background about my family. My dad came here when he was still in high school, a kid lucky enough to get out of the refugee camp he'd been living in for months after his native country was taken over by the Communist Army. He went into the camp with his siblings, but one by one, they got sponsors and left. Eventually, it was just him. He's never talked to me about his struggles there, but his siblings have. I remember the first time my uncle told me that the authorities in the camp made my dad hand out food to everyone, one cup of rice per family, because he was a kid and people were less likely to get angry with him when they were starving, or how they would see casualties burning just outside the camp, people that hadn't made it through the terrible conditions. When Dad finally did get a sponsor and come to America, it was a religious family that took him in. He's always been grateful and gentle with them, even in his recollections. He didn't hold it against them that they forced him to go to church, to worship a God he didn't believe in, instead of worshiping the way he found meaningful. Dad, you see, often hung out with the Buddhist monks in his country. He liked their quiet. He liked their dedication. He liked their teachings. To this day, he still reveres them, which blows my mind. My father is not at all monkish or quiet or still. He's the kind of man that goes and goes, achieves and achieves. He didn't hold it against anyone that instead of teaching him the language, they simply moved him back a few grades and let him struggle. He doesn't think it's amazing that he still graduated on time with kids his age, got a college scholarship, and has since learned Spanish to add to his Lao and English, and worked two jobs, and raised me, and somehow closed the cultural divide with my mother enough to be married for more than 30 years. He doesn't think that's amazing, but I do. For some reason, I've always had a strong distaste for missionaries. Maybe it's the savior complex I don't like. Maybe it's that there seems to be so little consideration for the culture they go into. So little understanding that there's literature and history and art that's already there. Maybe I'm mad for him. A sort of generational anger that I've inherited because he didn't think it was worth being upset. I seem to be able to both know that people go into missionary work with nothing but the best intentions and find it distasteful that they see people who I can only see as similar to my father, as the have-nots.
Last week, I talked about some things in my and our histories that are hard to hold, and about holding our hearts open to the feelings that come up when we consider those hard things, so that we might learn to hold them more lightly and use them to move toward healing. So this morning, I'm going to practice a little truth telling. This is good and hard and good. Mandy told us a hard story from her family history during our time for all ages and the impact that that story has on her life. And I honor the courage and the vulnerability it took for her to do so. Thank you, Mandy. Especially because my own story, some of which I shared last week, my own story gives me to inherit the myth of domination and white supremacy that is on the other side of Mandy's story. And I have grown and had to process my own guilt around that. Mandy's story offers us some of the impacts of that myth and the anger that she's inherited because of it. It takes courage and vulnerability to own stories from our collective past that produce guilt or shame too. So this morning, I offer us some words from Unitarians and Universalists and Unitarian Universalists in our history that were thoroughly grounded in the culture of their time. And I encourage you to let those words fall into your hearts. Our first words are from the Reverend Henry F. Bond, who in 1886 was brought in by the American Unitarian Association to run one of their three attempts, their only successful one, to, quote, undertake educational work amongst the Indians. Bond and his wife ran the boarding school on the Crow Reservation in Montana, called the Montana Industrial School for Indians, or Bond's Mission School. And Bond is recorded as saying this about the Crow students: "They're all bright, promising boys. How such good-appearing fellows come of an ignorant, lazy, squalid, orphaned race is a constant surprise to us. I shall dread the time, if that comes, when they slip back into their old abodes and possibly leave." In November of 1986, the UU World magazine published a picture of this school with this caption. This is 1986. The caption reads, "The Montana Industrial School for Indians was established in 1886 by the American Unitarian Association. Founded by the Reverend Henry F. Bond and his wife Pamela, the school, also known as Bond's Mission, was located on a Crow Indian reservation near Custer Station on the Big Horn River. 50 Indian children at a time lived at the school, which taught farming, mechanics, and the domestic sciences. Students and faculty posed for this photograph in 1888. The school closed after a decade when the federal government withdrew the $108 per pupil annual subsidy. The buildings were sold to the government for $1. This piece told the truth, but without acknowledging the harm done by Bond's words and the AUA's actions. Now, I think maybe we know a little better. And when we know better, as the saying goes, we can do better. The 2012 UUA General Assembly passed a resolution repudiating the doctrine of discovery and calling for full implementation of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. We are putting the link to that resolution in the chat so that you may read it at your leisure. And there's a whole section of the UUA website dedicated to repudiating and dismantling the doctrine of discovery, also in the chat. Because I want to read all of these things to you, and that would take all day. I will be delving into that website to learn what a process of truth and reconciliation with the Indigenous people in our area might look like, beyond the first step of offering an acknowledgement of the lands our ancestors stole from them. I'd love to know if any of you would like to join me in that work. There is a UU Justice Action Network in Washington State that participates in the local interfaith network for Indigenous communities, for which we're posting a link in the chat. This is a group that I think I would like to do some learning from. The group issued a statement last month that says, in part, quote, "Our first commitment as the Interfaith Network for Indigenous Communities is to listen to our Indigenous siblings, to hear the truth they have been telling, to do what they have been asking, and to do all we can to advocate that this truth be heard." It continues with a specific commitment to, quote, "work closely with the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition in their efforts to document these truths and advocate for a National Truth and Healing Commission. We support and pledge to work with Interior Secretary Deb Haaland as she establishes a federal Indian boarding school initiative. We call upon our member faith communities to establish their own boarding school truth and healing initiatives to proactively work with, provide information to, and complement the work of Secretary Haaland's initiative." I found a list of 11 American Indian boarding schools in Wisconsin on Wikipedia, including the Toma Indian Industrial School, which Wikipedia says opened in 1893, was an off-reservation government boarding school in Wisconsin, located along a main railroad that connected Chicago, Milwaukee, and St. Paul. It provided education for children from the Ho-Chunk Nation of Wisconsin. The boarding school was the vision of white policymakers and administrators, the article continues. As the first school of its kind to exist in Wisconsin, it was esteemed for its literary education and religious influences. Most students were members of the Ho-Chunk Nation, but the school also served Ojibwe, Oneida, and Menominee students from reservations in Wisconsin. So maybe there's a place for us to start. I offer next, in segue, several quotes from Unitarian ministers who, again, like Henry Bond, were enculturated in their times. First, from Theodore Parker, who wrote in an 1851 sermon he called On the Fugitive Slave Law, "I have in my church black men, fugitive slaves. They are the crown of my apostleship, the seal of my ministry. It becomes me to look after their bodies in order to, quote, save their souls." He continues, "This law has brought us into the most intimate connection with the sin of slavery. I have been obliged to take my own parishioners into my house to keep them out of the clutches of the kidnapper. Yes, gentlemen, I have been obliged to do that, and then to keep my doors guarded by day as well as by night. Yes, I have had to arm myself. I have written my sermons with a pistol in my desk, loaded with a cap on the nipple and ready for action. Yea, with a drawn sword within reach of my right hand. This I have done in Boston, in the middle of the 19th century, have been obliged to do it to defend the innocent members of my own church, women as well as men." You may recall from some of my other preaching on Unitarian history that Theodore Parker was shunned by other UU ministers, partially for his strong stance on abolition. So a couple of opposing views from other Unitarian ministers. The same year, Orville Dewey, who was the assistant to one of our most well-known forebears, William Ellery Channing, wrote, "If a fugitive came to me, professed his divine right to be free, and asked for help, I would reply, 'Your right to be free is not absolute, unqualified, irrespective of all consequences. If my espousal of your claim is likely to involve your race and mine, together in disasters infinitely greater than your personal servitude, then you ought not to be free. In such a case, personal rights ought to be sacrificed to the general good. You yourself ought to see this and to be willing to suffer for a while, one for many. If I were in your situation, I should take this ground." And earlier, in 1838, Theodore Clapp, minister of the Independent Unitarian Society in New Orleans, wrote, "I would say to every slave in the United States, you should realize that a wise, kind, and merciful providence has appointed for you your condition in life. And all things considered, you could not be more eligibly situated. The burden of your care, toils, and responsibilities is much lighter than that which God has imposed on your master." So, I bring us to present. The Reverend David Petit, a longtime UU minister who served as director of ministerial credentialing for the Unitarian Universalist Association until he passed away last year, learned in the early 2000s that his ancestors had been slaveholders in New England. And he wrote the story of his search for the descendants of those people his family had enslaved. I don't have time to share that story with you today, but it's posted in the chat, and we'll link it on our website where today's reflection will be available. I will offer his shorter quote from an article he wrote in 2007, "Claiming Our History, Warts and All," is what he called it. He wrote, "I've wrestled long and hard to understand if I'm now responsible for the actions of deeds of those who lived before me. If I allow myself to be disconnected from history, then I am off the hook. But when I acknowledge my true relationship to our community of memory, I can no longer make sense of the privileges I have inherited. I know that these comforts I enjoy are a direct product of the labors of others who were denied the opportunity to pursue their own dreams. We must be willing to claim all of our history, warts and all," he says. And finally, from the same year, words from former UUA President William Sinkford. He says, "There's a kind of liberation that comes with being able to actually know our past and talk about it freely. If we're not able to talk about it freely, that past gets built into the walls in ways that we have a hard time seeing." So yes, these are all things our ancestors have left us to reckon with. Many of us experience generational anger or blame or shame at these things and things like them in our histories. Many of us in our personal lives have done or are doing work to heal both the impacts of our and our ancestors' actions on people in oppressed and marginalized communities. And our congregation has also done work to understand and dismantle the culture of white supremacy. And this year, that work will center around whether we adopt the eighth principle, the text of which we're putting in the chat. This work is necessary if we are to become whole, if we are to do what Karen Johnston said. "Lest the whole remain in pieces. Let us practice honoring truth-telling, lest we falter and fail. Lest the whole remain in pieces." And this work is only beginning. I look forward to where it will take me and where it will take us. I want to close with a poem from Rilke's Book of Hours that doesn't seem completely to fit, but it's a poem that has hit my life a couple of times this week in different ways as I have been pondering what to say today. And so I bring it, because not everything has to make sense up here. This one hit me here. He wrote, "I live my life in widening circles that reach out across the world. I may not complete this last one, but I give myself to it. I circle around God. Around the primordial tower. I've been circling for thousands of years and I still don't know. Am I a falcon, a storm, or a great song?" Thank you, friends. May it be so. And may we be so.